Well, brethren, I wanted to give a sermon. We have given sermons in the past on this. I actually did in Dufuniac Springs and in Mobile on the pagan festivals. But I wanted to ask a question today, and it's based on a question that I was asked several years ago. I was in Dallas, and I was going to do a Hispanic Bible study. And I asked them in advance if they would write some questions in, questions that were on their mind. And this was about this time of year. One of the ladies wrote back, and she said, and I'm quoting here, she says, "On the Sabbath after January 1st, I have brethren who come up to me at services and say, 'Happy New Year's.' And it confuses me. Should we celebrate this event, and can you clarify the church's teachings on celebration of New Year's?" You know, questions like this arise from time to time. We're very solid when we think about the days that we know stem from paganism, like Christmas and Easter, Valentine's Day, etc. We're very clear on those. But what about some of those days that may seem less pagan-oriented and more nationalistic? And I want to go through a few of those. Every year we have people that write in and ask questions about Mother's Day, Father's Day, President's Day, Martin Luther King, Thanksgiving. Are those days that we should be observing, or because they're not God's holy days, should we let that go? Since we're at the end of this calendar year, I thought I would cover the question of New Year's. Should we celebrate New Year's? Before answering that question, I want to actually do a deep dive into the historical aspect of New Year's. I actually was quite amazed by this. I had no idea before going through this how convoluted the idea of when is the New Year. It has been all over the map. You, from generation to generation and from kingdom to kingdom, the New Year has been celebrated probably almost every day of the year at some point in time, somewhere in time. And I wanted to go through a few of those. It may surprise you to hear this. So when is the New Year? Well, if you look back at ancient Egyptians, the Phoenicians, and the Persians, it was always at the fall equinox, Halloween. October 31st was the start of the new year at the equinox. In ancient Mesopotamia, it was at the spring equinox, which is the Easter celebration. That's when ancient Mesopotamia had it. In ancient Rome, they always set it as March 1st, as the first day of the year. And you may not realize this, but in ancient Rome, they only had 10 months. In fact, if you look at the naming of the months, the old names still stuck. September, October, November, December. Sept, Oct, Nov, Dec. 7, 8, 9, 10. So they started March 1st. They ended December 31st. And the year was 304 days long that they counted. And then that period of 61 some odd days that was the dead of winter, well, nobody paid attention to that anyway because that was winter after all. So they didn't count the days. I mean, during that period of time, if you said, "What's the date today?" they didn't have a name for it. So they went from March 1st through December 31st and then just had nothing for a period of time. That was the first king of ancient Rome, Romulus. He is credited with starting that calendar. The names of the final 4 months, as I say, September, October, November, December, are a holdover from them. The second king of Rome, Numa Pompilius, didn't like the idea of having 61 days of nothing. So he was actually the one that created the months January and February. But they were at the end of the year. The year still started on March 1st. So January was actually the 11th month of the year, and February was the 12th month of the year. And in ancient Rome, the start of the year was March 1st. The problem with that is, even with that addition, the Roman calendar was only 355 days. And as you know, the turning of the year is 365 and a quarter days. So every year they were off by almost 10 days. So what they started to do was every other year they would add an additional month, which brought it up to 366 some odd days. Now they are wrong the other way, and it was hopelessly convoluted. Even if you look at our calendar today when we've got to do leap years, and then there's, I don't remember what they call it, but there's a leap year, but then there's a something else where there's even an additional day that gets added every once in a while. We have that problem too, because the days and the months and the years don't exactly line up. So every year they would add an additional month to approximate the solar year. At first, January and February, like I said, were at the end of the year. And over the next 600 years, the Roman calendar became hopelessly confused. The idea behind March 1st, by the way, through December, was the growing season. So you start in March 1st, and that was roughly planting time. And then you went through to December, where everything died, and then there was no reason to count anything because everything's dead. So you just hunker down for the winter, and you wait until March 1st when you can start planting again. The emperor could change the days anytime he wanted. The College of Cardinals for the Catholic Church could change the calendar anytime they wanted. And in those ensuing 600 years, there was a political football to figure out how long this year would be. So if there was somebody in power that somebody wanted to get rid of, they would shorten the year so that they could have elections sooner. And if someone was particularly not liked but had a lot of power, he would lengthen the year to make sure that he could stay in power longer. And so it was a real mess. And it was all done based on whatever the powers that be said. There was no set standard for it. Considering also that every time they changed the calendar, they had to print a new calendar. And back in those days, you printed a new calendar by etching it in stone. So you can see how irritating that might be for someone trying to say, okay, well, the emperor just came along and added five more days to the year. Now I've got to go chisel out my calendar and start over again. It was a real problem. The first time that the new year was celebrated in January was in 46 BC by none other than Julius Caesar. He got to the place where he was so frustrated with the calendar that he decided to start over. What he did, different than what they had done in the past, was he got astronomers, scientists, religionists, and had a council, and then decided at the council what to do to try and get the calendar fixed. It was decided at that time to move the new year from March to January, because that was the beginning of the Republican or civil year. That was when all of the elections took place. Not unlike our elections that occur in November, but they take effect at the first of the year. So it was Julius Caesar's idea to start the calendar in January. Now, I would like to read this. This is actually very interesting. If you ever want to read this, this is a very long article, but it's very good. It is from the website infoplease.com, and you look up calendar, and they have this on it. I want to read a little bit of this. In 46 BC, Julius Caesar introduced a new solar-based calendar that was a vast improvement on the ancient Roman calendar, which was a lunar system that had become wildly inaccurate over the years. The Julian calendar decreed that New Year would occur with January 1st, and within the Roman world, January 1st became the consistently observed start of the New Year. So obviously with Rome being the major superpower of the time, that wielded a lot of weight, and so a lot of the extended Roman Empire, because of the weight of the emperor and of the Catholic Church, decided to change it their new year to January 1st. In medieval Europe, however, which was just outside the purview of Rome, medieval Europe, the celebrations that accompanied the new year were considered pagan and unchristian. And in 755 AD, the Council of Tours abolished January 1st as the beginning of the new year. At various times and in various places throughout medieval Christian Europe, the new year was celebrated on December 25th, on March 1st, on March 25th, at the Feast of Annunciation, or possibly at Easter. So depending upon what country you went in, they all had a different religious event that they would start the new year. In other words, it was still all over the map. There still wasn't a common way of deciding when the new year would start. In 1582, the Gregorian calendar reform restored January 1st as New Year's. Although most Catholic countries adopted this Gregorian calendar, almost immediately it was only gradually adopted among Protestant countries. And get this, and I'll bet you didn't know this. The British, for example, did not adopt the Reformed calendar until 1752. Prior to 1752, in Britain and in the colonies, New Year was March 1st. So it's a relatively new thing, having January 1st. Until then, the British Empire and the American colonies still celebrated New Year in March. The month January got its name from the Roman god Janus. So you wonder where that name comes from. Sometimes we look at names and wonder. Like September, October, November, December, those are pretty easy. That means literally 7, 8, 9, and 10. But the first several were named after gods. January was named after Janus. If you've ever seen pictures of Janus, he has two faces. One is always looking backwards, and one is always looking forward. So one face is looking back at what just happened, and the next face is looking forward at what's going to happen. So it makes sense that that would be the god, the Roman god of the new year, because you're ending one year and you're looking forward to or starting another. One looking back, one looking forward. He was also called the god of gates because you were leaving one. It's like when you go from your front yard to your backyard, you go through a gate. You were leaving one year and going into another year. Or he was sometimes called the god of beginnings. Again, this made sense to Julius Caesar as the end of one cycle and the beginning of another. So gradually that became the accepted calendar date, where January 1st, almost universally, is now accepted as the date of the new year. Now, it does make sense from the perspective of trying to get everyone's calendar aligned. We're in a global economy now, in a global world, and to have even some companies that have a fiscal year that starts in January, or others that have a fiscal year that starts in July, that can be even problematic for some people as well. So that gives you a little bit of background or history. I thought you would find that interesting, that relatively recent, the United States has only kept January 1st as New Year's since 1752. When is the new year according to the Bible? That may sound like an obvious, but let's go through, and I want to show you what the Bible tells us, and then I want to show you some complications that arrive as a result. Let's go back to Exodus chapter 12. Exodus chapter 12, and I want to start in verse 1. Exodus 12. And in verse 1. Now, this is after the Israelites have left Egypt. Now, why would God need to tell them this at this point in time? It says, verse 1, "Now the Eternal spoke to Moses and Aaron in the land of Egypt, saying," so they're just leaving now. They're just the process of leaving. Passover is about to be instituted. "This month shall be your beginning of months. It shall be the first month of the year to you." This was in the spring. So God is now establishing that the spring lunar month would start the calendar year. "Speak to the congregation of Israel and say, on the 10th day of this month, every man will take a lamb according to his father's household. If the household is too small, let the neighbor and he get together," etc. "You will keep it until the 14th and then you will sacrifice it." We know the 14th day of the first month is Passover. So God instructed Moses during the Passover season that that month was to be considered the first month. Why did God have to tell the Israelites when to start a year? If you will remember what I just read, in Egypt, the celebration of the new year would have occurred at a different time. In fact, during the time that Israel would have been in captivity, the new year in Egypt was around mid-July, and it had to do with the flooding of the Nile River. That was an annual event. Every year, the Nile flooded. And that was considered the start of a new year, because when it flooded, it brought life-giving waters out to the area where they were able to plant and they could start their season. So during the time that Israel would have been in captivity, the new year would have been celebrated in mid-July. So as they come out and as God is about to bring them out of Egypt, he tells them, "I am setting a new date for the new year, and it will be in the spring of the year." Israel would have only known the Egyptian date, and God modified this for Moses. Now, it only makes sense because of the holy days, starting with Passover, that God would start the calendar at the start of the religious season. So again, it is a lunar calendar. So the first crescent of the moon is the first day of the month. On the 10th day, you get the lamb and you put it aside. And on the 14th day of the month, at the full moon, that's when you would have Passover. The Hebrew calendar, again, was lunar. So it was at the first sight of the new moon. And you might assume that the Jews today have this date for their new year because it's established in the Bible, and you'd be wrong. The Jews changed it. Let's read about that. Today, the Jews have their new year starting at the Feast of Trumpets. In fact, if you look in the Bible, you can look back in Exodus 23, and we'll go there in a little while, where it says that the Feast of Trumpets was called Rosh Hashanah. Rosh means the head, and Hashanah means of the year, the head of the year. The Feast of Trumpets was literally called in the Bible the head of the year. And we'll read about that in just a moment. The first appearance of this date being attributed to the new year first appeared in the 2nd century AD and was written down by the authors of the Mishnah. Now, if you know anything about the Mishnah, everything prior to this was, they had the Torah that was written. They had the writings, right? They had the prophets. But there was a lot of oral tradition that was never written down. And somewhere along the 2nd century AD, the religious leaders in Judea said, we need to write this stuff down or it's going to get lost. So they started to write it down. And it was in the writings of the Mishnah where the first written account of the new year will start on the Feast of Trumpets. So that's the 2nd century AD when we get that. It is believed that God gave Israel this date for the new year in the spring for the holy days. But if you'll look, let's go to Exodus 23 and verse 16, and you'll see why there's a little bit of confusion. Exodus 23 and verse 16. Remember I told you that we have I'm saying them wrong. I'm trying to remember what the term is, but the year that the financial year that starts in January is called something, and the financial year fiscal and that starts in June or in July is called, there's another term, and I have an MBA and I can't remember the term. It's been too long since I've been in school. But anyway, we have two calendars based upon whether you want the finances to start in January or in December. It's similar to here. We have a calendar that starts on the first day of the month in the spring as a religious calendar. But also, I want you to notice what it says in Exodus chapter 23, and let's start in verse 16. Actually, let me go back a little further. Let me start in verse 14. Three times a year you will keep a feast to me in the year. You will keep the Feast of Unleavened Bread. You will keep it 7 days as I commanded you. For out of Egypt you came. None will appear before me empty. Verse 16, the Feast of the Harvest, the Feast of First Fruits of your labor which you've sown in the field, and the Feast of Ingathering. And then notice what it says, at the end of the year. So there was an end of the year to the end of the harvest season. So you plant in spring, you harvest at Trumpets, Atonement, Feast of Tabernacles, around that period of time is when you bring your last gathering in. And it even says here in Exodus 23 that after the Feast of Ingathering, that was considered the end of the year. So the Jews, being less religious in one sense and more agricultural in one sense, decided that perhaps there was two beginnings to a year. There was a religious beginning, which would occur in the spring with the Passover, but there also was an agricultural beginning, an end of the year when you brought your last crops in, then heading into winter when nothing is grown. I mean, they sowed winter wheat and stuff, but it wasn't harvested until later on. So they, at some point in time, the Jewish writers during the Mishnah decided that there was a start of the year that would occur at the Feast of Ingathering, which was, in their estimation, Rosh Hashanah, or the head of the year. Let's go to Exodus 34, and you'll read something very similar. Exodus chapter 34. And I want to start in verse 21. Exodus 34 and verse 21. 6 days you will do work, but on the seventh day you will rest. In plowing time and in harvest shall you rest. So now what is he talking about? Is he talking about the holy days, or is he talking about the agriculture? This section here is talking about the agriculture. Verse 22, you shall observe the Feast of Weeks, of the first fruits of the wheat harvest, and the Feast of Ingathering at year's end. Now, again, in Exodus 23 and here in Exodus 34, when you look at these words, they basically are saying this same thing, Rosh HaShanah, the head or the beginning of the year. Verse 23, three times will your males appear before you, and they go through and they say the same things three times in the year. But they call it here again the end of the year. So the end of the harvest season was also considered the end of the year. One way of reckoning the new year was by the harvest, the end of the harvest, and the other was by the start of the holy day cycle. So in ancient Judaism, they really had two New Year's days. They had the first of the month the start, where the 14th day of the month would be Passover, but then they also had the end of the harvest season, when the one harvest would end and another would begin. What a confusing history. Go back and you look at the Mesopotamians and the Egyptians and even the Jewish calendar and the British and the English and the difference between the Catholics and the Protestants. Oh boy. So what's right? What is the new year? So I go back to the question now, is celebrating January the 1st wrong? I want to look at that from the perspective of what God might say and what God might think. Is celebrating January 1st as the New Year's wrong? First of all, January 1st is obviously found nowhere in the Old Testament as good or bad, since January 1st wasn't established until 46 BC by Julius Caesar. So January the 1st would have never even been considered as the New Year. So if you want to look at the Old Testament and try and find out whether it's okay to keep January 1st, it's not going to be there. There was no January 1st by then. That was a new thing. We see no mention of any New Year event from Egypt or any other nation mentioned in the Old Testament. So we go back in the Old Testament and say, what did the other nations do? We know from history that Egypt kept it at the flooding of the Nile River. That is not mentioned anywhere in the Bible. We know that ancient Mesopotamia kept it at a certain time of the year. We know that the ancient Phoenicians kept it at a certain time of the year. The Bible makes no mention of any New Year celebrations in any nation anywhere in the world. By the time the New Testament came along, January 1st would have been the New Year for the Roman calendar. The Roman calendar started with Julius Caesar in 46 BC. Jesus Christ came in 27 to 31 AD, and the apostles wrote the New Testament through 100 AD. So they would have been very aware of the fact that the Romans kept the New Year on January 1st. And yet there is no mention of New Year's celebration, Roman New Year celebration, in the New Testament. It's simply not mentioned. They would have known about it because Judah was under Roman rule. There is no direct scripture observing any other nation's New Year activity in the Old or the New Testament. Indeed, there isn't a mention of observing the Jewish New Year in either the Old or the New Testament, with the exception of those two scriptures that I read that said, on the first of the month, this will be the beginning of months. There is nothing else written in the Bible at all about celebrating New Year's. So is it right or wrong? That's where we come to the judgment. What do we judge on this? One way of judging something that is not explicit in the Bible is to use what the Bible does tell us about celebrations or about the fruits of it, and then try and come to an understanding of whether something is right or wrong. And that same would apply with Thanksgiving, Mother's Day, Father's Day, national holidays that are set aside. By looking at what the Bible does say about celebrations and then looking at the fruits of the day itself, we can make a judgment on whether or not to observe it. Now, if you think about let's just set aside this for a minute. We'll come back to this. But let's look at the whole idea of Mardi Gras. There's nothing in the Bible that talks about having a parade as good or bad. But I doubt if there's any of you that would say, that's Mardi Gras, let's go down and throw beads and let's go. We know better because of the observance of Easter that goes with that and Lent and all of the baggage that comes with it. So while there's nothing in the Bible that says don't have a parade, we would be able to judge and say, this is a bad idea. We need to stay away from this. By looking at the celebrations of the Bible and what it says about it and the fruits of those celebrations, we can make an informed decision on whether it's a good idea. I actually would like to look at a celebration that was observed outside of the annual holy days and sanctioned by God. Let's look at Esther chapter 9. There actually are two of them. One of them is actually in the Bible itself, and that's Esther. We'll read about what Esther says about it. But then you also have the issue of Hanukkah, which we'll talk about in just a moment. Esther chapter 9, and I want to start in verse 18. Now, you remember the story of Esther? You've got Haman, who's the bad guy, and he sets the to get Mordecai killed and Queen Esther and all of this stuff, and at the end, the Jews prevail. I want to go to chapter 9 and verse 18 and read what it says here. I want to read quite a bit of this. So Esther chapter 9, verse 18, but the Jews who were in Shushan assembled together on the 13th day as well as the 14th day. And on the 15th of the month, they rested. And they made it a day of feasting and gladness. Therefore, verse 19, the Jews of the villages who went in the unwalled towns celebrated the 14th day of the month of Adar with gladness and feasting as a holiday and for sending presents to one another. Oh, now that, boy, that almost sounds like Christmas, doesn't it? All right, so this is not a part of the festivals of God. This is a celebration based on the fact that the Jews were protected by God, and they took 2 days, set it aside, had parties, had gift giving, and they did a celebration during this time. Verse 20, Mordecai wrote these things and sent letters to all the Jews, near and far, who were in all the provinces of the king Ahasuerus, to establish among them that they should celebrate yearly the 14th and 15th day of the month of Adar. This was a national holiday, similar to Thanksgiving, similar to Mother's Day, Father's Day, President's Day, etc. Verse 22, as the days on which the Jews had rest from their enemies, as the month which was turned from sorrow to joy for them, and from mourning to a holiday, that they should make them days of feasting and joy and sending presents to one another and gifts to the poor. So the Jews accepted the custom which they had begun, as Mordecai had written to them, because Haman, the son of Hammedatha the Agagite, the enemy of the Jews, had plotted against the Jews to annihilate them. And they had cast poor, that is, they had cast lot, to consume them and destroy them. But when Esther came before the king, she commanded by letter that this wicked plot, which Haman had devised against the Jews, should return on his own head, and he and his son should be hanged in the gallows. Verse 26, so they called these days Purim. That's the plural of poor. Poor means to cast a lot. Purim means lots. That's the plural of poor. After the name poor. Therefore, because of all the words of this letter, that they what they had seen concerning this matter and what had happened to them, the Jews established and imposed upon themselves and on their descendants and all who had joined them that without fail they should celebrate these 2 days every year according to the written instructions and according to the prescribed time, that these days should be remembered and kept throughout every generation for every family in every province in every city, that these days of Purim should not fail to be observed among the Jews, and that the memory of them should not perish among their descendants. Then Queen Esther, the daughter of Abihail, with Mordecai the Jew, wrote with full authority to confirm this second letter concerning Purim. And so it was established as a national holiday. And this is a Jewish national holiday to this day. I want you to note something about Purim. So let's ask some questions. What does the Bible say about this celebration? This one is mentioned. Is there anything in here that says it's a bad idea? Anything in here that says it's a good idea? What we see from here is that God saved Judah. So note that this isn't in conflict. This isn't a replacement of a holy day, right? So think about Passover versus Easter. There was a period of time when the Council of Nicaea got together and said, instead of keeping Passover, let's keep Easter. And instead of keeping Saturday, let's keep Sunday. And they made replacement changes. This doesn't do that. This doesn't involve a sacrifice to another god. If you think about the January 1st celebration, where there were sacrifices that were made to Janus, This isn't sacrificing to another god. It didn't originate from a pagan tradition. It's a day of thanksgiving to the true God for his intervention with Judah. And the Bible ascribes this as a day that is proper to observe. It isn't commanded to observe. We don't have to keep Purim today as the Church of God. But, and I've heard Ralph Levy say this, there's nothing wrong with celebrating Purim, to be able to give thanks to God for protecting the Jewish people during this period of time. It's an entire book of the Bible dedicated to God's intervention in the affairs of ancient Judah. Same thing with Hanukkah. If you look at that, Hanukkah comes from what happened in the intertestamental period. Won't take the time to go through that today. That is another time of thanksgiving for God's intervention in his people. We would look at the U.S. celebration of Thanksgiving in the same light as this festival of Purim. God did protect the people of this nation. We're going to hear about that some on January 26th when Mr. Franks comes here and gives a sermon on bringing the Sabbath to America. That wasn't an easy thing. Those brave souls that came here, I have been watching. You all know I'm a sci-fi nut, but there's a program on called Mars right now that's going through what it would be like to colonize Mars. And they keep going back to what it would have been like to have come over on ships to colonize the New World. There was no returning. In fact, a lot of times when they got to the New World, the captain burnt the ships so that they couldn't return. They were forced to stay there. They were forced to make a life. And among those people, God brought the Sabbath. When we give celebrations on the Day of Thanksgiving, most of the world looks at that as a non-religious event. It's a time to have a lot of food, and it's a time to watch football. But when I think of Thanksgiving, I see it very differently. I see it as similar to the Feast of Purim, where we give thanks to God for not only bringing into effect the United States as a promise directly to Abraham, that we believe that the United States is a direct result of the promises to Abraham. So in one sense, the celebration of Thanksgiving is the celebration of the promises to Abraham. And we celebrate that to this day. But now let's go back to New Year's. So I think if you look at Thanksgiving, you look at Mother's Day, Father's Day, those don't have pagan implications. They're not replacing holy days. We look at those and say, okay, it's not wrong to have a national holiday. But what about New Year's? I want to read from another website. This is called beliefnet.com. This is quoted in some articles that the church has on Life, Hope, and Truth. And it describes the New Year celebration in ancient times. So I want to read through some of the history of January 1st, and then we can apply our filter. Is this a good thing or a bad thing for the Church of God to keep? Belief.net describes the celebration in ancient times as this. The ancient New Year celebration actually was 6 days long. It started on December the 25th and went through January 1st. So it is associated with Yule or Saturnalia or the Christmas season. It was 6 days long. Now, later on, when they got to England, 6 days wasn't long enough. So what did they change it to? They changed it to Christmastide. And how long was Christmastide? Who remembers the song? 12. The 12 days of Christmas, right? That is related to the ancient pagan celebration of it being 6 days long, starting December 25th and ending on January 1st. I'm reading now from beliefnet.com. New Year's Eve, with its emphasis on romance and indulgence, might seem like a secular celebration, but underneath all that glitter and sparkle is an ancient holiday with deep spiritual roots. For centuries and in similar ways, people have been observing the end of one year and the beginning of another. Ancient Romans celebrated these 6 days with carousing that would probably be familiar with us today. Because the winter solstice was the turning point of the year, beginning the lengthening of days, it was long viewed as the birth of the year by pagans celebrating the return of the sun god. The days between solstice and New Year were a magical, luminous time period when anything was possible. So New Year's is directly related to Christmas. It was, in ancient times, a six-day celebration, where today we might look at them separately as we have New Year's or Christmas Eve, where you open your presents, and New Year's Day, where you watch football. But in ancient times, they were connected. As a result, these days have close ties to Yule or Christmas. During that period of time, the Romans would offer sacrifices to Janus on these days. And if you look at some of the events that happened today, you can see where that came from. A part of what they did in honor of Janus was they celebrated by putting laurel wreaths on their doors. They hung mistletoe and had, the obvious idea behind mistletoe is if you get underneath it, you're allowed to kiss someone who's not your wife. That was an ancient part of Rome was very erotic in a lot of ways. I never understood mistletoe. It's a parasite. I would have think they could have chosen something else. What are those plants that they always sell around Christmas time? The poinsettias. Wouldn't that have been a better? I mean, the poinsettia is not a parasite. I don't know how that got started. It soon spread to gift giving from one another. The gift giving started with giving gifts to Janus. Then it later on morphed to giving gifts to the emperor, who was in Janus's place. And then it became, well, we're going to give it to Janus and we're going to give it to the emperor. We should give it to each other. And so the whole idea of gift giving was not originally a part of the Yule and New Year celebration, but it got added as a result. The Christian church outlawed the celebrations of January 1st in AD 755, since it was so closely tied to pagan rituals and observances. So even Protestant Europe recognized the tie-in to ancient paganism and outlawed it for a period of time. While many in the church would recognize that celebrating Christmas is a bad idea, many don't know the link between Christmas and January 1st. So as a result of that, the church would view the celebration of New Year's as similar to the celebration of Christmas or the celebration of Easter. The roots of it are steeped in paganism, and as a result of that, to celebrate it as a religious event would obviously not be a good idea. Now, we're not done yet. Stay with me. I want to look at the biblical construct of worship because there's more to it than just that. Let's go to Deuteronomy chapter 12, and anytime we have a discussion of whether or not a holiday should be kept, we always turn back to this same thing. Here's another biblical mandate on whether or not we should observe days that have a tie-in with ancient paganism. Deuteronomy chapter 12. And let's start in verse 29. This was God's original intent for ancient Israel as they were entering the new land. When the Eternal your God cuts off from before you the nations which you go in to dispossess, and you displace them and dwell in their lands, take heed to yourself that you're not ensnared to follow them after they are destroyed from before you. Don't inquire after their gods, saying, how did these nations serve their gods? I will do likewise. So the church has used this as one of the backbones of whether or not to observe certain observances. If the background behind an observance was, this observance was to honor a pagan god, then ancient Israel was not to take that and say, well, I'm not honoring their pagan. If you read what this says, how did they serve their god? I'll do likewise, meaning how did they serve their god? I'll use that same observance and I'll worship my god that way. It says, you shall not worship the eternal your god in that way. He's very clear as to what he's saying. He's not saying they were worshiping pagan gods, but that they were taking the practices of pagan gods and worshiping the true god that way. The winter solstice was the ancient pagan sun god that they were worshiping. Christianity said, well, we won't worship the pagan sun god, we'll worship Jesus. But they kept the same traditions, and they started to observe that in a Christian manner. God's very clear here saying, don't worship me in the way that they worshiped their gods. That alone should tell us that the Christmas to January 1st is a bad idea. Certainly to observe January 1st as a religious event would not be pleasing to God. But while people today don't observe this as a religious celebration, it nevertheless uses the ancient pagan religious symbols, which the church feels is inappropriate. All right, I want to read a couple of New Testament scriptures here and then one in the Old Testament to give us a couple of other ideas from the Bible of what we should and should not be doing. Let's go to 1 Peter chapter 4. 1 Peter chapter 4, and I want to read verses 3 and 4. By the way, I was told with some people in Mobile that Mardi Gras actually started there instead of New Orleans. Is that great? A lot of heads are shaking, yes. I also heard that there was some, I don't know if it was in France or somewhere in Europe, where they did something similar to Mardi Gras-type celebrations back then. I think of things like that. I think of Christmas. I think of Easter. I think of even New Year's when I read 1 Peter 4, verses 3 and 4. For we have spent enough of our past lifetime in doing the will of the Gentiles, walking in lewdness and lust and drunkenness and revelries and drinking parties and abominable idolatries. In regard to these, they, the rest of the word, thinks it strange that you don't run with them in this same flood of dissipation, speaking evil of you. I can remember working back at Nortel, and we had they wanted to have a Christmas party, and I was one of the managers, and in fact, I was in senior management at the time, and they wanted me to come to it because all of those people that work for you are going to come, and you're the figurehead, and you're not coming, and this is wrong. And I explained to them, I can't go, and I told them why. So they moved it from the 25th to like the 28th, and then tried to make it more of a New Year's theme. And I'm like, you know, guys, I know you're trying, right? I mean, I want to read this again. Verse 4, in regard to these things, they think it's strange that you don't run with them anymore. What's the matter with you? Well, anyway, so unwisely, I said, okay, you've moved it, you've done all this, I'll come. And then when I got there, there was a Santa Claus. And I thought, so that was it. I learned my lesson. I'm not going to do that anymore. But notice some of the things that it says. Drunkenness, revelries, drinking parties. That's highly also associated with January 1st. The heaviest day for DUI arrests and drunken parties in the United States is January, the eve of January 1st. In fact, I would encourage all of you, please don't get on the road that night. Just find a nice book, a glass of Chardonnay, and just stay home. That's what I would recommend for you. Mistletoe, the kissing at midnight, all rooted in pagan sexual activities. Resolutions. Originally, New Year's resolutions were making resolutions to the god, Janus, of how you would respect and honor him more in the new year. And then that morphed to making resolutions to lose weight and stop smoking and all of the other things. Attending parties with excessive drinking. That should be off limits to a Christian any day of the year. And would encourage you, if you have a New Year's party from your office, that may be something that you want to avoid, because it's just a bad idea. Watching football in the Rose Parade is not participating in a sinful activity. In fact, when we worked at Ambassador College, we worked the Rose Parade. Marlis, you probably did that too, but during the eve of New Year's, when the Rose Parade people were setting up, we had security for the college campus was right at the start of the Rose Parade, and there were just millions of people, and we had to be on security duty to try and keep the college safe. It was kind of a mess during that time. So watching football in the Rose Parade is not participating in sinful activity. Having friends over for dinner to watch the parade or to watch football, that's not a sinful activity. I watch football on, I think that's probably a lot of the college bowl games are on January 1st. If I were to try and outlaw college bowl games, you would run me out on a rail. But the idea behind it is, again, you're not observing New Year's, you're watching football and you're having some friends over to enjoy that, as long as it's done in that manner. Let's go to 2 Corinthians chapter 6. I've got a couple more scriptures that I want to read in regard to this. 2 Corinthians chapter 6. And I want to start in verse 14 and read right through to the end of the chapter. 2 Corinthians chapter 6. This is often read for the idea of who we should be married to, but this isn't specifically what this is talking about. This is also talking about whether, as example, being in a business partnership with someone who's not converted is a good idea. It says, don't be, verse 14, unequally yoked with unbelievers. For what fellowship has righteousness with lawlessness? What communion has light with darkness? What accord has Christ with Belial? or what part has a believer with an unbeliever? Now I'm going to stop there and just think about what he's saying. What part has Christ with Belial? The Christmas and the New Year celebration take ancient paganism or the worship of the Baals, the false gods, and try and put a spin on it and say, well, we'll just do it in a Christ-like manner. This is saying very, very specifically, you don't mix those. You don't take one and do it the other way, or you don't take the other and do it the one. What part has a believer with an unbeliever? Verse 16, what agreement has the temple of God with idols? All those pagan gods were idols. For you are the temple of the living God. As God said, I dwell. If you are the temple of the living God, why would you take that and bow down or prostrate yourself before a pagan idol or a false god? As God has said, I will dwell with them, I will walk among them, I will be their God, they will be my people. Therefore, come out from among them and be separate. Don't touch what is unclean. And I will receive you, and I will be a father to you, and you will be my sons and daughters, says the Almighty, says the Lord Almighty. Now, I want to read on through the first verse of chapter 7, because when Paul wrote this, there was no chapter break. This is someone who decided that this was a different topic, but it's not. Because notice what it says, the first word in chapter 7, verse 1, therefore. This is based on what he just read. Don't get involved. Don't try and become, take pagan things and make them Christian. Therefore, having these promises, beloved, let us cleanse ourselves from all filthiness of the flesh and spirit and perfecting holiness in the fear of the eternal. We need to get to the place where we recognize that instead of renaming pagan customs as Christian and then allowing new converts to retain some of their former practices, the Apostle Paul commanded them that they should leave those sections of worship behind. All right, two more scriptures. This one in Hosea chapter 9, I actually want to read from a different paraphrase. Hosea chapter 9, I want to read parts of verses 1 through 6. Think about the celebrations of Christmas and New Year's and all of the things that go along with it. The mistletoe, the drinking parties, etc. Again, I want to read this, Hosea chapter 9, verse 1. I want to read this as the Message Bible paraphrases it. It says, don't waste your life in wild orgies, Israel. Don't party away your life with the heathen. So I think we would see that very clearly with something like New Year, with Mardi Gras. But somehow on New Year's, it just doesn't seem quite that bad, but it is. You walk away from your God at the drop of a hat and sell yourself into promiscuity. All that party food won't fill you up. You'll end up hungrier than ever. At this rate, you'll not last long in God's land. And some of you are going to end up bankrupt back in Egypt. Some of you will be disillusioned by Assyria. What's he saying here? All those things that you're worshiping or that you're honoring, those come from Assyria and from Egypt. They didn't come from God. They came from the worship of their gods. So get yourself separated from that. As refugees in Egypt and Assyria, you won't have much chance to worship God. Sentenced to rations of bread and water, your souls will be polluted by the spirit and by the dirty air, and you will be starved for God. Will you be homesick for your holy days? Will you miss festival worship of God? Be warned, when you escape from the frying pan of disaster, you will fall into the fire of Egypt, and Egypt will give you a fine funeral. So it's very clear. It's just saying stay away from that. When you come out of it, get out of it and stay out of it. And finally, let's turn to Ephesians chapter 5. Ephesians chapter 5, verses 10 and 11. You know, when trying to figure out whether to keep something, whether to keep Mother's or Father's Day or Thanksgiving or some other day, this is a good thing for you to look at. Ephesians chapter 5, verses 10 and 11. Find out what is acceptable to the eternal. That's a real simple sentence, but there's a lot of depth to that. What does God think? In anything that you do, would God be pleased with this? Is God, that, put that in whatever, Mother's Day, honoring your mother. Would God be pleased with that? Yeah, I think so. Honoring your father, yeah. Honoring, thankful to God that he protected this nation. Yeah. Honoring the fact that he protected the Jews during the Feast of Purim. Yeah. Learn what is acceptable to the eternal. And then when you do, verse 11, have no fellowship with the unfruitful works of darkness, but rather expose them. And that's what I hope we're doing today, exposing them. So in conclusion, what's the difference between simple, harmless fun and displeasing God? As stated, there's no biblical injunction against celebrating New Year. So how do we decide if she would observe it? I actually have some suggestions. I have four suggestions for you. They're just points. This will go quickly. We'll be done here in just a few minutes. But I thought I would read through this. Not just in New Year's, but for any decision that you have to make on whether or not it's a good idea. Point number one, look at the root. Right? The flower of a plant might look really good, but look at the root. What's behind whatever type of celebration it is? Why was the celebration developed? What are the customs? What were the customs intended to do? Why do they have those customs? Why have mistletoe? Why have gift giving? What was the purpose behind it? Do a personal study on things like resolutions, mistletoe, origin of the month of January, the worship of Janus. All those things will help you make an informed decision to look at the roots, point one. Point two, was the celebration to praise the true God? Was the celebration to praise the true God? All of the festivals listed in Leviticus 23 are in worship and praise of the true God. Purim, Hanukkah, U.S. Thanksgiving, those, I believe, are in worship and honor of the true God. While not biblically commanded days, the observance of national holidays that honor God are certainly allowed. Point three, which would be the opposite of point two, was it to honor a false God? Was it to honor a false God? If it originally was set to honor a pagan god like Janus, as most of the New Year celebrations are, these times of asking false God to bless them during this arbitrary day of the new year, the Bible is clear that we are not to honor false gods. We're not to keep those celebrations. And then finally, point four, does it involve rituals that are not pleasing to God? There's nothing wrong with football. There's nothing wrong with eating dinner. But when it comes to alcohol in excess, that's a problem. When it comes to mistletoe or other things that have its roots in paganism, that's a problem. Quoting from an article in Life, Hope, and Truth, this is called The Roots and Fruits of New Year's Eve. I just want to read this as a final thought. Superstitions and customs that may seem quaint or harmless to most people can actually be repulsive to God, who knows their roots and their fruits. Brethren, the Bible does give us excellent advice and guidelines on how to interact with this world while we still maintain godly principles. We have his words, we have the ability to discern right from wrong, and it's with those that we should use them.